money is not inherently wealth. It's a way of measuring wealth, but not wealth itself. And money that is created without any productive activity shouldn't be considered wealth inherently. Second point, sound money would curb people's ability to fake, because it would take more effort, actual productive effort, to make that money, and therefore there would be productive, you know, means to that productive end. And thirdly, if we measure our progress and our economic activity by mixing up spending wastefully and investing thoughtfully, then we don't know what actually the real situation is. Hello and welcome to WS Podcast. My name is Wojciech Salski, I'll be your host for today. And before we begin, may I just remind you, if you haven't already, please make sure to follow, subscribe, click that button on whichever platform or tool you're listening to the podcast. It helps the show to grow. It gives me a signal that I'm doing something better or worse. And if you'd like to support the podcast in any other way, maybe by sending me an email or just by reaching out, commenting, you can always follow the link below. And there are plenty of ways to do so. I am very grateful for all of you who are listening, for you who are listening, for all of you who are sending out me emails and essentially reaching out. You know, I've had a wonderful start to the year. We're just finishing up the first quarter, and it's been great, and I can see it becoming just better and better. Plenty of exciting stuff to do and to work with. I wouldn't be surprised if by the time you guys hear of this episode, I am recording it in advance. Potentially, maybe the advertising will also be there for my new website on which I'm working on, and so forth. So really exciting. I'm very happy to be here, and I'm happy that you are here as well. So thank you so much, and let's dive straight into it. So as you might remember or not, and I did prepare notes from my last week's episode with Paul, with whom we've discussed essentially his book called Capital Offense, Why Some Benefit at Your Expense. Last week, we've discussed with Paul essentially what is wrong with the financial system in which we are living currently. And of course, you know, in essence, it's at its roots wrong, because its foundation is reliant on broken money, okay? And we've explored that again and again with multiple episodes by now, but I will remind you again today, what does it mean that money is a sound money versus a broken money, or maybe not money at all if you think about it. But what we've discussed last week, essentially with Paul, was what can we do about it? We've explored what would actually a free market capitalist system look like. And Paul made it really obvious that we are not living in one. And as far as our understanding of history goes, we've never experienced a fully free market capitalist system. This is something that is actually in line with what Jeff Booth claims in his work, The Price of Tomorrow, the first episode of this season. So I'll make sure to also I'll link it as well for you, plus obviously Paul's episode from last week. And we've talked about practical steps. We've talked why houses are not actually assets, or at least they are not productive assets in a way that they are portrayed as an investment. We've discussed growth versus consumption, and we've talked how did we get here from since 1971 as the major sort of breaking, the final link being broken in the at the foundation level of our financial system. And so I would encourage you to listen to prior week episode first if you haven't already, and it will probably be useful. But even if you don't and you are here and you'd like to stay, then what I've done is I basically summarized on my notes here and on my notes in paper version, I've summarized other parts of Paul's book, which we've not touched deeply enough, I think, on. And yeah, I'll link below the book for you to check it out. Unfortunately, I have it only in a digital version, so I have nothing to sort of show here. For all of you who are not watching the video, I basically just don't have the physical copy with me right now. But yeah, my hope for today, for this episode for you, is to sort of drive the point home so you can understand from Paul's perspective, through the lens of what we've discussed before, what is money and why the way money is being treated nowadays is not necessarily true to its essence. Why GDP, which is gross domestic product, and it's a measurement, a KPI if you want, key performance indicator, that you know, contemporary economics uses these days to measure growth in a country, in a country's economy, why according to Paul it is misleading, and why it should be either adjusted or simply scratched, or why you should not rely on it as a means of measuring your progress. And we will also discuss how sound money will protect us as a society, and how it could if we got back to it. And if you did listen to the episode from last week, you remember we sort of riffed with Paul about whether or not it's actually possible to come back to some sort of sound monetary system. Personally, as much as I'd like to believe that, I mean, of course it's possible, everything's possible, whether it's likely, I'm quite skeptical. I don't know. Maybe in my lifetime, maybe in your lifetime, it would be wonderful. Although, as I did mention on the show again and again, no man is better than their incentives. There is this idea, no one of us is better than our incentives. And so if the incentive is there for someone to continue with this system, however broken it might be, they probably will. And you know, we will explore that. Hopefully it's not doom and gloom all around, but yeah, you know, I'm hoping that by the end of this episode you understand these three concepts a bit better and you're better equipped to take charge of your financial education, of your financial adventures, and so forth. Also, I just wanted to share with you, if you remember, I actually made an episode about it a while back. I did finally cleanse myself from any debt I had after being essentially stolen from. So that's a great achievement. It took me 3 years, and here we are. So to all of you out there who are potentially, you know, struggling financially in some way, I understand, you know, maybe not to the same degree. Each of us has a different path to walk, but I'm with you and you can do it. It's just consistency in action, just small steps day after day, and you can do it. If I can, and I'm just an average Joe, really, then you can too. And all the power to you. On that front, let's get into it. Sorry for such a long introduction, I guess. So, in terms of the book itself, I think what Paul pointed out as the mission of the book is really a good outline of what he achieved, I believe this book to be really, really useful for someone who wants to understand the problem with this capital offense, as Paul calls it, with the economics in which we live and nowadays, in a very simple, no bullshit way, right? So if you haven't already, if you haven't read any books on personal finance, or maybe you've only had a chance to read one or two, and you are looking for a book that will enable you to understand the problems in particular with fractional reserve banking, and at the same time you want a book that is not too long and not too daunting, not too complex. And this is a big point that we've also touched on with Paul, that, you know, there is a lot of financial and accounting and economics jargon which is being used, in my opinion, purposefully to mislead you to think that it is something too complex for you to understand. Well, if I can understand it, you can too, I promise. Paul is obviously a 30-year experienced investor, so I have no doubt he understands it. Whether I have the qualifications for it, I don't know, but I know that I've come to grasp it and appreciate the simplicity of economics and personal finance as I learned about it. So I would encourage you to try, and you know, don't be scared of the jargon. This book in particular is the one that will help you overcoming that, simply because Paul refrains from using any of these and will try to demystify them as we go as well. So first, let's read the quote from the book that I marked. This is about the topic of what is money. Money doesn't make the world go round. That's done by the hard work and ingenuity of billions of people who create goods and services. Money is used to facilitate the exchange of all that stuff, all of that hard work. And it's the hard work and ingenuity that gives us all purpose. Now, the point that Paul makes in the book fairly early on is that we need to understand what makes up money, what money is, to be able to appreciate and comprehend what the problem with this system that is supposedly claiming to point to some things as money is about. And, you know, the sales point, let's say, of any fiat currency, and if you remember, fiat means nothing else but by decree, legal by decree. So someone said that it is so, and therefore it is. So fiat currency is any currency you use right now, anywhere in the world, really. So for example, for Poland, it's going to be Polish zloty. For UK, it's going to be British pound. For any of the European Union's in the European Union countries in the Eurozone, it's going to be euro. And then, of course, you have United States dollar in the United States and so forth. So that's a currency. It's a means of payment, of course. It's a unit of account as well. It seemingly serves as money, which, of course, in a sense of paying with money, it serves, it does. The thing is, though, and this is where the first claim from Paul comes into play, that money itself is not wealth, even though we are led to believe that it is, because we measure wealth in money. Okay, so for example, if you think of a rich person, what you might think of might be, you know, a really nice car, or maybe a certain lifestyle that they lead, maybe a, you know, buckets or tables filled, or even bathtubs filled with pounds, dollars, liras, whatever, pesos, whatever you want to use. So it's like this abundance of wealth, okay? And that's a portrayal. Okay. The thing is, though, there is a great difference between the lifestyle, the wealth that essentially means you have resources, you have the capital that you can deploy to make sure that you get what you need and more and enjoy free time, essentially. You don't have to work all the time as many people do. But it doesn't necessarily mean the currency that you hold in your hand, okay? Because if you have a lot of currency in your hand, let's say that you're a billionaire, but if you're a billionaire in the wrong kind of currency, if you're a billionaire in the salt currency, I don't know if you know, we've talked about it on the show before, but if you, you know, in the past, at some point, salt was used as a means of payment, as a form of money. Nowadays, of course, you know, if you were to sell everything you have and just buy lots of salt and hope that that will take you far, it's going to be probably quite difficult to claim that you're a millionaire. Of course, you can be a millionaire in salt, but I don't think anyone will bat an eye, and effectively you will squander your wealth, okay? But the point here is, Paul pushes back against this intuition that money itself is wealth, and instead he argues that money is a representation of prior production. So what was mentioned in the quote, that it's something that represents the production that, you know, happened before, a claim on real goods and services, so something that you can use to make a claim on something, for example, to make a claim on buying a car, and a facilitator of exchange, but it's not value in and of itself. And this is the crux of the matter, right? We measure wealth in money as a unit of account simply because it's practical, it's useful, it makes sense, it's easily accountable. It's much more difficult if we were measuring wealth in cars, for example, because every car is slightly different, right? And even if you have 60 cars that are exactly the same, if you're measuring wealth against someone who has a different brand of a car and has 60 cars that are the same but of a different brand, it's kind of difficult to determine which car and which wealth is greater, especially that if you remember from our previous, or maybe it's going to be next week episode, I don't remember, sorry, I'll remind you the concept. The concept that we know from praxeology, from this, sort of science, I guess, an attitude of just measuring the human action, how it happens. Nothing has intrinsic value. We give value to things, right? And value is obviously inherently subjective. What I value as something of great importance, you might not care about at all. Even, you know, in terms of spending our time, think about it this way. If you have a podcast and I have a podcast, then potentially we both value having a podcast. But if I have a podcast and I value it and I give it my time and you listen to my podcast, you don't value the same thing, right? Because I value creating the podcast while you value just listening to it. And it's all okay. It's a subjective value. If I were to maybe offer you to change places, if you liked and if you valued creating a podcast, maybe you would say yes. But if you prefer to listen and not to take part in creating it, then you will value it less than me, right? So if we focus about this, if we pinpoint this idea that currency and money in and of itself has no value unless we give it value, right? If it's just a measurement of our wealth, of our ability to, you know, get goods, get services, or in our, you know, if it's a representation of what productive activity we've done before, or if it's a facilitator of exchange that allows us to measure those cars and then account, you know, each car has a certain price, certain sort of price tag. What is a price tag? A price tag is essentially a signal of what the market or you or the person who's willing to sell it is asking for it. It's a measure of account of the value, but it's not the value itself, right? The value itself is what you get out of that car when you drive it, or maybe if you want to keep it in your living room, then that's the value you want. But it's not the price tag that you value, because if it was the price tag that you value, then you would just buy the price tag and you would leave the car at the dealership. So if we consider that and we agree that effectively it's just a measuring stick of a sort, then we understand, we can start to look at the root of this economic error, where money is treated as wealth rather than a symbol of wealth. And then it becomes much easier to policymakers and, you know, central banks and everyone involved in this fiat monetary system we live in to justify creating more of it. They essentially, they can make a claim that they are creating something of value simply by clicking the print button and printing more of inherently valueless paper. And if you've lived through any hyperinflation, you will definitely appreciate it more of how valueless is a paper effectively. You know, even if you have a £5 note in your pocket right now, in 20 years' time, if it so happens that someone decides to change the way the £5 note looks like, and the £5 note that you have in your pocket is no longer a considered money, then effectively it just becomes a very fancy looking plastic, you know, paper. Because in Britain we have those plastic, you know, kind of paper money. So you see here, this is one of the really interesting points that Paul made, and it made me think deeply about it, that because you mix up, it's like this story, right? If I point at the moon, don't mix up me pointing at the moon with the moon itself, right? Don't mix up my finger with the moon. Because if you do so, then you're missing the point. And in the same way, don't mix up the zeros on your account with wealth. Because if you do, you might wake up one day thinking that you're very wealthy, but you're actually living in a hyperinflation environment and your millions of pounds are worth just about a lollipop, you know? So don't mix up wealth with value. This is the point. And of course, because you can mix them up, someone who's making value out of thin air, which is effectively not valuable, right? If something is fake, it's less valuable than something that isn't fake, right? That's why we like original pieces of art and not the fake ones. In the same way, if someone is printing money out of thin air, they've not done any work to do so, and they will gaslight you to think that they are giving you value, they are increasing value, giving you wealth simply by clicking that button, then you are effectively being scammed, right? And this is the first point. So, of course, you know, this kind of situation, this kind of situation leads to an illusion. It leads to a perception that, you know, both the central bank and the government, when they decide to print some more dollars, pounds, euros, yens, whatever, it leads to a perception that somehow they are creating value for you and the world, right? And of course they are not. They're actually doing the contrary, because whoever is already holding that money, that hard-earned money, and this is the point, if there is no proof of work, if there is no productive, creative, productive, whatever, if there is no value added from which that money was earned, if it's just button clicked produced, then effectively they are scamming those that produce and that create and that generate actual value, okay? So this is really, really important. Now, since we're talking about sound money and all that, I guess let's leave GDP for a second. We'll go to how sound money might protect society. A funny story, and I'm not sure if it's true. I found sources that say, that claimed it is. I found sources that claimed it isn't. It's difficult sometimes to discern what is true or what's false, so just take it at face value. But the anecdote about sound money apparently comes from the idea that when gold or silver coins were used back in the day, they would make a certain sound when they were dropped on the ground, and they gave a certain ring, right? And this is why the sound money was the sound money. It was the money that would be recognized as real, as good, as valuable. And of course, if you had coins that looked like golden coins, but then they were made of less high quality, less, you know, effectively royal metals, one can say, then the sound would be different when you drop them on the floor. Okay, of course, you know, as I said, I don't know whether it's true or not. Some people say it's true, some people say it's not. But it is informative, let's say. Because effectively, what we're exploring here is that someone was able to discern whether whatever is being given to them is true or false. Okay, and this is really, really important. Think about it. We live in a really changing life. Your life is changing every day. You're experiencing all kinds of, you know, adventures every day. You're meeting all kinds of people. You're eating all kinds of food. You're drinking all kinds of drinks. You're engaging with all kind of content, right? And nowadays we have this with AI. You know, this is a rabbit hole to dive into, but how do you discern what's true and what's not plays a huge role. Even if you are not struggling to survive, knowing what is true and what's not plays an important role, right? Like, you wouldn't go to the shop and buy a bunch of food that you don't know whether you're buying food, or maybe you're buying a drawing of food, and you would spend all the money that you earned this month for papers that show food. And then how would you eat? Are you gonna eat the paper? You know, so discerning what's real and what's not plays a huge role. We don't like when people lie to us, right? We lie to ourselves a lot, probably. Most of the time, I think, in some circumstances. And of course, you know, it's something to strive to not do. If you try to be true to yourself, I applaud you. Please do so. It pays a good value for it. But you don't like when someone lies to you, right? No one likes it. No one likes when they're even underinformed. You know, even more so when they are being lied to. And now, if the sound money is the truth and the fake money, unsound money, is the fake, it's untrue, then by knowing how to discern true from false, we can establish our relationship a bit better. If I'm trying to sell something to you and I say that it's worth this and this much, and it turns out that I lied to you, it doesn't help our exchange, right? You will not trust me and the exchange will probably not happen. You will be really disappointed with it. I will lose, you will lose. It's a lose-lose game all around. In the same way, when we are using money which is broken, we are establishing our foundation of civilization, the exchange, you know, a sort of program, transactions, on a broken system, right? This is so, you know, maybe informative, and I'll get back to what we were supposed to do, sort of. Sorry, I sort of jumped on a tangent. I, as you can tell, I'm quite, you know, excited about the idea of sound money. Think about it this way, and this is absurd, right? But this is how we live nowadays. And I promise you that. Just check if that's true. Don't take my word for it. Check it for yourself. If your money is constantly debased via inflation, and if you want to learn more about inflation, please refer to the episode about inflation. I'll link in the show notes. Of course, we've talked about inflation excessively by now. If your money is being debased by inflation at all times, and yet you are using the same currency, the same money, to measure the prices of the things that you have and you buy, then isn't it the same as measuring a table with a measuring stick which is constantly changing? Just imagine how crazy would that be if you went to the shop and you bought 2 kilograms of potatoes and the shop clerk would be deciding on the spot just how much 2 kilograms of potatoes is, right? This is pretty much absurd, but of course that's essentially in the system that we live in. And don't get me wrong, even in a monetary system where money were to be once again gold, as it used to be, or maybe in the future it's going to be Bitcoin, whatever, of course the price tag might change slightly over time, but it will not be inherently wrong. It will not be reliant, and this is one of the things that you can certainly rely on in the central banks, because it's literally written within their constitutions, within their goal of the central bank, is to keep inflation at 2% or, you know, whatever central bank you'll check out. So it's inherently made to change. Inherently, over time, you are promised that your money will be worth less over time, and you will be measuring everything with an increasingly, you know, shrinking ruler. That's effectively what it does, right? So now let's leave that. I hope that you understood. And if you haven't, we'll be still driving that point home for a few more weeks. So bear with me. Now, let's read the quote and explore the topic. Commodity monies were a great benefit to society and a great inconvenience for governments, because wealth could not be so easily siphoned off from the citizenry. They could still do it, but it would happen at a much slower rate than it does today, as it was much more difficult to do so. Commodity monies essentially means all kind of money that is a commodity at the same time. So, for example, gold, silver, maybe salt, oil, you know, if you were gas, whatever. It could be timber, but effectively it was mostly gold, you know, and gold-based system is what we're referring to here. And according to Paul, it was a disciplining force in the economy because it limits the ability to it limits the ability to expand the money supply on a whim, right? Of course, if you think about it, if that's the case, if money cannot be expanded just because someone said so, these things happen, right? First of all, you have the protection of savings. So it prevents the silent erosion of purchasing power, the dilution that we've explored, and it ensures that there is a deferred consumption retaining value, right? So if you're saving nowadays in your local currency, you are promised to lose a percentage of it over time simply because it's there. Okay, you are promised a 2% minimum loss year on year. And if you know anything about compound interest, That is actually quite a bit. Just account for that. Figure out for yourself, maybe do a little calculation with ChatGPT or whatever, how much of compound interest will you effectively lose over 10 years if you had 2% inflation? And of course, wink, wink, inflation is higher than that, effective real inflation. Now, it also limits government overreach because governments cannot easily finance deficits through money creation, right? They cannot just come up with more gold out of thin air. They actually have to dig it up. And that is a proof of work. That is a productive venture. And so it forces fiscal discipline. There is no spending just for the sake of spending because... And just do this mental experiment for yourself. Have you ever been given money from someone else to do something with? Without consequence. Let's say that your parents gave you some money and you had pocket money or whatever. Whenever we are managing money that is not ours, unless we are really, 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 you know, sorted out in our minds about it, you are much more likely to not be frugal with someone else's money. So why do you expect the government or the central bank to be frugal with your money? Why would they? It's not their money. It's a very different story when you start earning your own paycheck and then you realize just how much money actually is worth, right? For you. Now, another one. It reduces wealth transfer mechanisms. So as we mentioned, right, there is inflation and having a commodity-based system prevents inflation, inflation-driven redistribution, effectively stealing from those that save to whoever else they will be giving out the money for. And it keeps economic rewards tied more closely to productivity, right? Of course, if it takes productive means to get money, then by definition, there is more production of value to begin with. And money is the end of that production and not the beginning, which is basically cheating. And it encourages long-term thinking because stable money promotes saving and investment, as we said, because you're not going to lose the value over time. And it reduces speculative behavior driven by cheap credit. And I will not go into credit too much in this episode. Paul explained to us last week, so please refer to the episode before. But the one thing that I will say about credit, and this is something that you need to really consider, is this. We are in a credit-based system nowadays. We are incentivized by banks and by all of the financial institutions out there who are trying to earn money on interest, earn on your interest. We are incentivized to borrow, right? You get a credit card, and what a credit card effectively is a way of borrowing from the future self. So you can buy now, pay later, right? Via credit, and also you have those systems which are effectively just buy now, pay later with some interest rate on top, which is just an extension of credit cards. But the problem with that is that it's obviously short-term solution. It's no solution really if you don't make your ends meet next month. So it's similar to drinking, right? It's similar to getting wasted, let's say it this way, not to drinking. When you party, when you go on a night out of any kind, it doesn't even have to be with alcohol. If you party so long in the night of Friday that you end up sleeping in on Saturday, what you effectively did, if you think about it, is you took a credit from the future self by taking some of Saturday energy and expending it on Friday, right? And of course, if you add on top of that drink alcohol or whatever, you might actually feel sick the next day. And if you do, then you've also taken the credit of good feeling from the day for the day before, right? So you've taken the credit from the future and then you will have to pay it back with your hangover. In the same way, when you pay with credit, unless you know what you're doing, you will potentially, I'm not saying you will, you might potentially fall into the trap of taking too big a bite this month and then trying to make your ends meet next month. And this is something that I just want to caution you on, because credit is nothing to be scared of, but you have to understand it. Otherwise, you should be scared of it. You should be scared of anything that you don't understand and you do, I think. Unless you purposefully don't understand it, because that's part of the game, but I wouldn't play that game with money. Don't take my advice if you don't want to. It's completely fine. Who am I to tell you otherwise? Now, so let's talk about GDP, right? Why is gross domestic product measuring misleading? Let's read the quote. Our current economic system is increasingly functioning as a wealth redistribution and capital consumption destruction mechanism, rather than one of true wealth creation in which all participants benefit. Wealth is not only being redistributed within this generation, but to this generation from the next. And this is the credit point, right? We've talked about it with Paul as well. If the way we act on a country scale, on a national scale or on the global scale, is that we're drawing more and more credit, we're effectively making our children and their children and their children and their children paying it back for us. And this is a tragedy in terms of making the future of a society better. If you come into a society which is expecting you to pay off the huge debt that they used to party, you will feel rather discouraged, right? And of course, this is what many young people feel these days because of the system in which we are since the 1971, effectively. Some countries even longer. So in terms of gross domestic product, if you understand, gross domestic product is effectively like however much a country's economy has produced. And of course, it should be however much value it has produced. But as we explored earlier, if we mix up money with value, if we mix up currency with wealth, then you can get people creating money out of thin air and calling it, you know, production. So Paul critiques GDP as a deeply flawed proxy for economic health because it measures activity and not value. It measures spending as if it was creating. And this is where the Austrian economics and the knowledge of it really plays a huge role. And I would encourage you to explore, and I would encourage you to check out next week's episode about praxeology, which is this, a way of understanding why we do what we do, and how human action and human behavior shapes our economy, because it's actually based on reality and not on some, changing measuring sticks as Keynesian economics, on which our system is based currently, is. So GDP counts spending regardless of whether that spending creates real wealth. Debt-funded consumption artificially inflates GDP, and government spending is treated as inherently productive, even when it may destroy value. And remember, government in and of itself does not produce anything, right? And it can get money for free by decree, by the budget which they work on with the central bank. They simply print money and spend it. So inherently, at its foundation, even if they spend it to invest, which majority they don't, but even if they would, there would still be a level of cheating the production as it is to begin with, because they first had to take it from someone. There is no free lunch, right? That's the saying in among the people that understand how economy works. There is nothing for free. And if you think you're being given free money from the government, well, rest assured that first they had to take a part of your money to fund it. Unless you're non-productive, unemployed, not doing anything individual, you are being milked for the government to be able to redistribute that wealth. And of course, there are benefits to it. I'm not criticizing it, you know, as a base layer. Think of it what you want. But what Paul is arguing is that we cannot measure something that starts by creating value out of thin air, which inherently isn't value. We cannot measure it as part of the valuable part, right? It's as if we had a competition in the room and there would be 9 people who are showing their sculptures and paintings, and then there is one person who isn't showing anything. And they are also participating because they claim that they have an invisible painting, which I'm afraid probably the postmodern modern art world already did. If they did, please send me an email or a screenshot of that. I wouldn't be surprised. But the point is here, you know inherently that that's lying. It's just not true, right? There is nine people in the room that have something to offer and one person who is pretending that they have something to offer. And what GDP, the way it's accounted for nowadays, is doing is it's claiming that that 10th person is also playing a part and they are not lying. And of course, you know, it's for you to determine. It basically creates an illusion, right? Economies appear to grow while underlying productivity stagnates. Policymakers are incentivized to stimulate spending rather than production. So GDP conflates quantity of transactions with quality of outcomes. It cannot distinguish between productive investment versus just wasteful spending and sustainable growth versus debt-driven expansion. This is huge, right? If you haven't gotten this, please rewind the past 10 minutes and understand this. If we are playing a game in which someone can pretend and be considered as seriously as everyone else who is actually playing, and we are okay with it, then are we all lying to ourselves? Are you okay with that? I don't know. Am I okay with that? I'll keep it to myself. But this is the point, right? You have to remember that money is not inherently wealth. It's a way of measuring wealth, but not wealth itself. And money that is created without any productive activity shouldn't be considered wealth inherently. Second point, sound money would curb people's ability to fake, because it would take more effort, actual productive effort, to make that money, and therefore there would be productive, you know, means to that productive end. And thirdly, if we measure our progress and our economic activity by mixing up spending wastefully and investing thoughtfully, then we don't know what actually the real situation is. The best way to put it really is like, if you have a family, right? Or maybe you just have a partner, or maybe with yourself. When you start doing your personal finance, and I hope by now, if you are listening to this show and you have already, you know, been to a few of the episodes, you know how important it is to understand your spending habits. It is the first step to become financially fluent, right? It is also the first step to become financially wealthy. Otherwise, I don't know what you're doing. But if you are measuring your spending, then If you were to do what effectively the governments and economists of our time are doing when they are measuring GDP and mixing up wasteful spending with investment-based, productive spending, it would be like if you took all of your expenses, both the ones that you have to do for your flat and, your education, whatever, your job-related or something productive, creating something, maybe funding a podcast or whatever, and you mix it up with partying and with, trips and adventures and everything. And then by the end of the year, you put it all on one list and you claim that you've been creating that much value, you've been investing that much in yourself. And then, God forbid, you put it on your tax form, claiming that you've actually invested all that money into making yourself and your business grow, what are you doing, right? It's absurd. It's crazy. It's, it's the same idea like if I give you £500 and you have to pay £500 to pay for your flat for the month, but instead you use that £500 to go for a little trip and then you don't have any money to pay for the flat, but you claim that you've paid for the flat. You're just lying. It's just not true. And then you get evicted. The thing is, though, of course, the way this charade is played, there is no one to be evicted because those who are in charge of working, in this system, those who are in charge of making this system run, are also the same ones who are keeping the system, in check. So it's almost like, this meme of three Spider-Men just standing, looking at one another, right? It's the central bank, the government, and then the financial controllers are looking at one another, and all of them have the plausible deniability, and all of them are essentially above law, right? It's like the law to D, not to me. Unfortunately, it's literally as if you were playing Monopoly and one of your friends who was playing the banker in Monopoly would also be the one playing and just treat bank as their personal account. I know you wouldn't be so happy about playing such a game. And this is the game that we're playing currently. Now, I promised that we will not finish on a downer note, so please follow the link below for the previous episode with Paul, where he actually offers his personal investment strategy, which I think is invaluable for you. Of course, the point of this show or any other show that you're watching is not to tell you what to do, is to make you think, and then you can decide what you want to do, right? But I would encourage you to listen to people that know what they're doing and then figure out why they do it and then decide whether you want to do it as well. So there is hope. I have no doubt. I believe that we are in a difficult time, but it will become better and better. And if you haven't already, please check out the other episodes. Over the past essentially 3 or 4 months, many of my episodes have been about how to make your money work for you, how to make yourself better financially, from the most basic ideas to the more complicated ones. But I will finish with this, and this is the invitation for you for this week. I've had a discussion with a friend of mine today at work, and it wasn't surprising, really. I mean, maybe slightly frustrating, but not surprising. I learned that he doesn't understand what we've just discussed. He doesn't understand what's the difference between sound money and inherently broken money. And so, following that line, he doesn't understand why what I'm doing is potentially beneficial for me, and while what he's doing is potentially not beneficial to him. Even though, as I thought, we're actually, you know, supposedly studying the same, you know, idea of economics and so forth. So I would encourage you to choose one of the books that I did mention on the show before. Maybe it's Paul's book about which we've discussed today. Maybe it's any of the others that we've discussed over the past few months. Choose one book, or maybe just Google a book on personal finance. Order it. Like, this is financial advice. Get a book. Read it. If this is the only book that you will read this year, read it. Please. And if you're like me, then you can read it within a few days, or maybe even one day, if you get really, you know, excited about it. Realistically, it will take you a week or two, and that's also okay. That's a great step. If you don't know anything about personal finance, this is your call. Just do it. Order one of those books. Some of them are really, really cheap. You can even get a used version one online, which is, you know, half the price. But this is the best kind of investment you can make. This is the productive spending, not the wasteful one. Because it will pay you back thousandfold if you read it and you understand. And hopefully you get interested enough to read a bit more and to listen to a bit more. And over time, and for me it took, I think, just about 2 years, over time you will understand this topic to the point that not only can you have a really, really cool, you know, insightful conversation with an expert such as Paul and enjoy the conversation and be stimulated by it and have fun, but even if you don't want to nerd out on this topic, you will feel certain and understanding and self-assured that you have your own back and you can make informed and skillful decisions. And this is my invite, this is my invitation for you for this time. And I'm pretty sure by the time you're listening to this show, this it's probably the 30th of April, or maybe just before. So you have just about 8 months more of this year. And this is the year where, while the markets might be going crazy and people might be panicking, and, you know, it does seem like we will be going wherever you are in the world through some changes, I believe it is also a great, great opportunity to wake up and to start educating yourself on the things that matter. Even if you don't care about economics, economics cares about you. And you can either ride the wave or you can get smashed by it, okay? And I know this might sound a bit dramatic. Personally, I do believe it's true. So choose one of the books. I would encourage you to choose Paul's, but of course there are many others and all of them are wonderful, or at least majority of them. Please refer to the other episodes and yeah, please take care of your education because no one else will do. On that note, if you are still with me and you haven't already, please follow and subscribe, either or, whatever. Maybe like this episode, maybe send it to a friend, maybe send it to your spouse, maybe discuss it with a colleague. Just let me know that I gave you some value. I hope I did. And if so, then yeah, please just join the club. Other than that, thank you for being and good luck. Thank you for listening. Thanks, Paul, once again for taking the time to chat with me last week. And yeah, all of you have a wonderful, wonderful week. Stay happy, stay healthy, stay wealthy, and I'll see you next time.